From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
In his recent assessment of threats to Australia's domestic security, ASIO boss Mike Burgess made the sensational revelation that a former politician had sold out their country, party and former colleagues to advance the interests of a foreign regime. Burgess did not name the person or the country, but since then there's been intense speculation about who that individual is and debate over whether the individual should be named. Burgess says he wanted to draw people's attention to the danger of foreign interference in Australia, but that to name the person would compromise ASIO's methods. Politicians, present and former, are claiming they know who it is, or declaring that it wasn't them. Commentators are divided about Burgess's action. A leak to the media has indicated that the country involved was, no surprise here, China. Meanwhile, former Prime Minister Paul Keating has used the Burgess speech to renew his attack on the security establishment in Canberra, declaring Burgess runs a goon show. Today, we're joined by John Blaxland, who is Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University. John Blaxland is co-author of the 3-volume official history of ASIO, and he's recently co-authored a book titled Revealing Secrets, An Unofficial History of Australia's Signals Intelligence and the Advent of Cyber. Professor Blaxland is currently director of the ANU's North America Liaison Office in Washington, and he joins us to talk about the spy issue and also the extraordinary state of United States politics. John Blaxland, how unusual is it for an ASIO chief to act as Mike Burgess has done?
ASIO chiefs in the past have inconsistent track record for public engagement. There have been some that have written books about it, about their experience. Some who have gone to the National Press Club, going back to the 1970s and 1980s, a succession of directors general of security figured that they needed to engage the public to explain their role, and particularly in light of the Royal Commissions of the Justice Hope in the 70s and 80s, there was a need to engage more publicly and more explicitly with the purpose, the rationale, and to explain why some things in the intelligence business just had to be kept secret. This reaches back to, you know, the experience of Charles Spry, who was Director General of ASIO for nearly 2 decades, from 1950 until 1969. He had been the Director General during the time of the Petrov defections and what they call the Petrov Royal Commission in the mid-1950s, when Menzies was accused of politicising espionage to keep Labour out of office. And what happens, and it's instructive because it's relevant for today, Spry refused to divulge why the so-called nest of spies needed to be dealt with but not sent to jail. Because this is the accusation was, hey, if this is a problem, why don't you just criminally prosecute them and deal with it out in the open? The problem was, back then, that the evidence that confirmed who was who in the zoo, in the so-called nest of spies, was patchy when it came to what Petrov and Evdokia had to say, but was criminally compelling when it came to the Venona decrypts. Venona was the code name given to the Soviet diplomatic reporting from the late 1940s that was decrypted by the Brits and the Americans. And it was only a short period of time that this worked because the Russians had known that one-time pads was the only way to have completely secure communications. But for a period when in the height of the World War II, they made a duplicate set of those one-time pads. And that duplicate allowed a crack, a window to open slightly for cryptologists to get in and decode and unthread the cryptographic information that exposed what was a nest of spies in Australia, but it also helped expose the Cambridge Five and the Manhattan Project spies as well. Very, very significant Venona project that at the time, Spry and others were trying to protect. So that information was never put before the Royal Commission, and it, of course, was completely damning to the nest of spies. That's, I think, a very instructive point, which I tell my students, you know, my class Honeypots and Overcoats, Australian Intelligence in the World, that in the espionage business, the secret of success often enough is in keeping your successes secret. You don't want to give the game away, because in doing so, you then give your target, the adversary or your potential adversary, the ability to work around your strengths and basically cut you off. So whether or not that's the case in what Mike Burgess has done in this quite extraordinary and very, you know, far-reaching accusation is something I can't comment authoritatively on. I can only give you that historical context as a point of reference that I think maybe helps partly explain why it's so ambiguous today in the public domain.
So is your instinct, however, that he's done the right thing, particularly in not naming this person?
So I'm actually a bit torn on this one, because I think that I understand why, on one level, in light of the 2018 legislation, he might not want to do that as something that would perhaps potentially fall through the cracks.
That's the foreign interference legislation.
Yeah, the foreign interference legislation. But of course, there is pre-existing legislation about criminal activity.
And this person's activity, we might just explain for the audience, was before that foreign interference bill was passed.
Correct. And it's not retroactive. So there is some, you know, question mark there about whether or not the utility of this is so consequential as to weigh more heavily in the balance than the confusion that's arisen and the Joe Hockey and the Paul Keating type of responses that it's induced. So my sense is, on balance, that I think I understand the rationale as somebody who's studied ASIO for a long time now in trying to send a message to would-be perpetrators and to would-be handlers, you know, the people who actually are managing people who are working on, who are on the take for another national government, to back off and to be more careful, and in so doing, perhaps disrupt current or prospective recruitment operations in Parliament or elsewhere.
Burgess argues that to disclose the name would compromise ASIO's methods, tell the other side, as it were, how they operated. But presumably the other side is very aware of the methods used in this case.
Well, not necessarily. And this is the point. This is why I use the example from the Venona, because I don't know the method that was used in this instance, but I do know that the Russians did not know there was a real concern back in the mid-50s that there was this considerable utility in being careful about how much you divulged, so that the Soviets did not get undue advantage from that information. And so there's a question mark now as to whether the target handler, the nation involved, actually knows how effective ASIO has been at disrupting. Because there's something else that, one of the things that good espionage agencies do is they try and flip their targets so that they become a double agent. And who knows, maybe there's half a dozen others out there. It's conjecture on my part. But it's not inconceivable that ASIO might be wanting to flip others who might be on the books as well, and therefore not wanting to show its hand too transparently as to how it managed to identify this and come conclusively, in their judgment, to that point.
I must say the speech read a bit like an extract from a spy novel in the parts concerning the former politician. I've just been reading Mincemeat, which is about an example of British activity in World War II, and I was reminded of it.
It's a cracker, isn't it? Well, this is the thing. You know, some of the best authors of spy novels are former practitioners. John le Carré springs to mind, and we quote him, Claire Bergen and I quote him, in our book Revealing Secrets, the new one on Australian signals intelligence and the advent of cyber. So, yes, the problem is that, sometimes art imitates life and life imitates art. And, you know, life sometimes is more bizarre than art.
Well, we wait for Mike Burgess, novelist, to emerge. In general, do you think it is good for the head of ASIO to be out there publicly talking in reasonable detail about the organisation's operations? Does this instill public confidence?
So I think if we look back in history, we saw a period particularly of disruption in the 1950s and 60s, where confidence in ASIO plummeted significantly. During a period of great protest, particularly during the Vietnam War, and there was a sense that ASIO had lost its way, and part of it had to do with the fact that ASIO was so secretive, people were kept too much in the dark as to what its purpose was, what its actions were, and what its role in society needed to be. And of course, part of the problem there was that, of course, it lost its way a little bit in the 1960s, which we talk about in volume two of the ASIO history, the protest years. And there's a period of reform in the 70s and 80s, which we talk about in the third volume of the ASIO history, the secret Cold War, when you see a regeneration and significant surge in accountability mechanisms, to the point where today we have in place, and we talk about that with my students, we have in the national intelligence community more oversight mechanisms than any other liberal democracy that I can think of, and I've studied several of them. So we have the NAC, we have the INSOM, the Intelligence and National Security Legislation Monitor. We have Cabinet itself, the National Security Committee of Cabinet, and then of course the internal mechanisms of the heads of intelligence agencies meetings, the Secretary's Committee of National Security, let alone residual powers of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and other bodies. So these are mechanisms that have complementary overlapping and not complete powers, but they do generate a check and balancing effect on the potential abuse of power by intelligence agencies. Now, just give you one example. One fellow who worked in what is now the Australian Signals Directorate told me a number of years ago now, he said, when they introduced the Intelligence Services Act, it felt like Damocles' sword was now hanging over their head. So essentially, with the ISA, the Intelligence Services Act, the Inspector General of Security, with enduring powers of a Royal Commissioner, can check every keystroke that has been written by that person who's being inspected. And that inspection can happen at the drop of a hat. So it is quite an intimidating power, and it affects everybody from a Director General right down to the cleaner. It's quite a sobering and healthy thing to have in the intelligence community, and it wasn't there in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It was really only introduced over time, and in the 80s, and the INSOM was a consequence of the Rudd government in 2010, introduced 2011. So a series of successive incremental increases to the oversight powers and mechanisms to keep in check the prospects of abuse and of excess.
And to reinforce public confidence.
Bingo. Yes.
Now, Australia's always, of course, been the target of foreign spies, but do you think we're more at risk now than, say, 20 years ago?
So a couple of things have happened which make us a attractive and lucrative target. One is, of course, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which has made it a lot easier to operate remotely, to reach from afar. And, of course, the advanced research on technologies, advanced technologies, quantum computing, artificial intelligence, hypersonics, precision-guided effects are all things that actually Australia is pretty good at. And we collaborate quite a lot with counterparts in the United States. There's a remarkable number of collaborative research projects that ANU, my university, and other Australian universities have engaged with counterpart research bodies in universities and institutions here in the United States and the United Kingdom and other parts of Europe as well. They are very attractive for would-be targeters of intelligence targeters, particularly from the more authoritarian states that have a track record of hoovering up such information. Australia has become all the more of a target since signing up to AUKUS, because AUKUS has, it appears, kind of accelerated the level of trust and collaboration that Claire Bergen and I talk about in the book Revealing Secrets as kind of the foundational trusted, top secret trusted collaboration that's been going on for generations, going back to 1942, that most Australians have very little knowledge about, but which our book seeks to provide greater insights into.
Now, Burgess has said that the spy that he outed or half-outed wasn't charged because the matter occurred before the foreign interference legislation of 2018. What impact has that legislation had?
So it's had a deeply sobering effect on political practice, on academic practice, on industrial practice. And it is having a sobering effect on anybody engaged in international affairs. People are now much more conscious of the risks that are involved in passing information or sharing information internationally over an insecure internet connection or with a partner whose credentials are perhaps not fully verified, and particularly when it comes to Russia, it's off the table, and North Korea, it's off the table, and similarly with Iran, the collaboration on those with those countries is virtually nil. It's very, very, very restricted, and with China, it has become increasingly restricted because of what has now become fairly well documented and hard to refute. What I think is well described as industrial scale competition and data access and retrieval. And this is through a range of cyber attacks, through data theft, really industrial scale snooping that it's pretty hard to look away from without being delusional and without kidding yourself about what's actually happening. It's game is on. There was an interesting book came out in the late 1990s called Unrestricted Warfare, written by a couple of Chinese colonels. And at the time, everybody thought it was like a little bit excessive and a bit of over the top. It talked about media, legal, and psychological warfare. And look, we're hung up on the term warfare because we don't think of what's going on as warfare. We think of we're at peace, you know. But in other languages, and I think this is fair to say for Mandarin, and I don't claim to be a Mandarin speaker, but I've had this explained to me, it's probably more accurate to describe what that book was about as unrestricted competition. And I think that's really what we're facing. We're facing gloves-off competition in media, legal, psychological domains. That's about accessing information, gaining whatever leg up advantage that can be gained over us in whatever way they can get away with. And that certainly resonates with the annual threat assessments that have been coming out of ASIO for the last few years. And it resonates with the scholarship I have been reading and others have been tracking in terms of the scale and the depth of particularly Chinese, but not exclusively Chinese, attempts to hoover up information and then store it and potentially use it for their own purposes.
So while that legislation is obviously a protection and serves as a warning, does it have negative effects too, in that it could harm quite legitimate cooperation?
So it's hard, you know, I think that's, to be fair, that's probably a not unreasonable observation to make. The question is whether or not the cost of that price is warranted. And I think, you know, successive governments, Labor and Coalition, with advice from successive national security leaders, have consistently advocated that view. And it's one that is railed against by China. Understandably, they don't want that view to become mainstream. but I think is pretty hard now to refute.
Now, Paul Keating this week again lashed out at the National Security Establishment in Canberra. He said that the leading people should have been sacked by the Albanese government as soon as it came to office. He believes that that establishment is too anti-China, too pro the United States. And I quote, he said, "These people display utter contempt for the so-called stabilisation process that the Prime Minister had decided upon and has progressed with China." What's your take on his comments?
So we can always rely on Paul Keating for colourful turns of phrase that are catchy, that are going to, you know, present a fantastic sound grab. There's no question about that. And he has once again delivered with aplomb. But beyond that, I think we need to be careful about reaching conclusions that I don't think are justified. I think it's also fair to say that ministers are briefed on what their departmental and agency heads do. They don't; these are not loose cannons, otherwise they wouldn't be in their jobs. They're professional bureaucrats have spent their lives in that space. But I think also there's a creative tension that has to be maintained between the position of a prime minister and a foreign minister engaging in diplomacy with their departmental heads engaged in that space as well, and a message to Australians internally. But of course, because the way the world works now, what is an internal message and what's an external message, they're completely blended. Nonetheless, for an Australian audience, there are important, I think, messages about caution, about sensible precautions that need to be taken, for which these agencies are responsible in to communicate. So I think there's, as I say, there's a creative tension we have to hold in our heads, and I don't think it's right. It's not a binary choice. And this is not what the government's doing. They're trying to be positive about the relationship with China as far as they can. They're trying to build, mend bridges that, you know, you can blame all sorts of people along the way, but there's no one single source. But certainly Chinese belligerence is a big part of that equation. The wolf warrior diplomacy, the sanctions haven't helped. The way perhaps previous governments have called things out could have been a bit more subtle, a little more sophisticated perhaps. But essentially, China's acted the way it wants to because it wants to. It is big. We are small. So the message is. We have to be sophisticated about what's going on here. A prime minister, of course, he wants to maintain good relationships with China. He wants to maintain good relationships with every country. Very similar with, very interesting, the conversations about ASEAN. And I noticed the former Prime Minister Keating was critical of Prime Minister Albanese for not taking to heart more what Anwar Ibrahim said. The officials understand that, you know, Anwar Ibrahim is sending a message for his domestic political consumption. He's sending a message for his Chinese interlocutors, and he's also sending a message about, hey, I'm not going to be told what to do by anybody. What Paul Keating didn't do was then quote the Philippines Prime Minister or the Singaporean Prime Minister who've come out with much more supportive statements about Australia's position and about their welcoming of the United States and their support for Australia. So, you know, we have to be mindful that quote one person, sure. What is interesting and in a little bit unsettling in my view is the consistency with Paul Keating slams our principal ally and major foreign direct investor and principal economic partner, let's face it, the United States, and yet screamingly silent when it comes to criticism of China. And that, I think, is deeply unsettling. And it's Shakespearean, even in terms of perhaps about the level of protest.
I want to turn to American politics, but one more question on the domestic scene. What implications do you think that the current conflict in the Middle East is having for Australia's domestic security?
Yeah, this is a deeply troubling one, and it's not just Australia's domestic security. It's happening in really pretty much across the Western world. We have very cosmopolitan societies, and we have not, I think, appreciated the depth of feeling about the Palestinian cause. That is, I think, being certainly amplified by the kind of media messages, and of course the extraordinary events, the shocking events in Gaza that have taken place over the last few months, going back to October the 7th, if not earlier. And, you know, it's devilishly difficult to think through what to say or what to do that's going to actually help here, because there are lots of facile proposed solutions to problems over Palestine that most of them are completely detached from reality. It is a enduringly vexed problem, which doesn't have any easy answers. And the government, you know, Joe Biden suffering this in Michigan with pushback from, you know, a predominantly Muslim electoral base in parts of that state. It's happening in the streets of Paris. It's happening in the streets of Berlin. It's happening in Melbourne and Sydney and elsewhere, where you have a population of Arabic speakers who are listening to Arabic news, which is unremittingly hostile to Israel, and on one level, understandably so, given what's happened in the recent months, but which doesn't speak to the nuance or the complications of what of the reality on the ground there, where Israel faces an existential crisis, and of course a known domestic political crisis that is, you know, I haven't heard a sensible, easy solution to the domestic crisis of Israel, let alone the external one. These are problems that are not going away. And Prime Minister Albanese, you know, the government is caught between a rock and a hard place, clearly eager for this war to end, for the killing to stop. But Hamas is doing, you know, everything it can to keep on hold of the hostages and to drag this on to make Israel pay over the long run. And along the way, our societies are being dragged into it. And this is, I think, deeply worrying. And it's understandable that that is, I think, something that is going to feature in future threat assessments as a problem, because we as a society haven't quite got our heads around the fact that we have significant bodies of our communities that think very different to what you get in the mainstream media, that think very different to, you know, the predominantly post-Christian, you know, but Judeo-Christian influenced thinking of most of the West. This is manifest most clearly in places like France and Belgium, where it's getting very, very ugly, the fight.
Let's turn now to American politics, and you're getting a bird's eye view where you are. We're recording, I might add, on Super Tuesday. The AUKUS arrangements are looking very messy. What's the current problem, and do you think it's possible that the deal could actually fall apart?
So I know there are people who have been almost gleeful in commenting on the hope that it might fall apart. And there are some voices that have been consistently critical of AUKUS. I don't think it's going to fall apart. I think it may well morph a little bit. The ambassador here, former Prime Minister Rudd, has been, you know, pretty impressive, actually, at the way he has worked Congress to ensure that Australia's interests are best served and understood. The passage of the legislation at the end of last year was miraculous, you know, in the context of a gridlock, political gridlock on almost every other issue, including Ukraine and Israel and the border. We managed to get the AUKUS legislation through. So there's going to be three, Congress has agreed to sell nuclear propulsion submarines to Australia. That is a remarkable achievement. The naysayers don't dwell on that point. They dwell on the occasional voice on the right of American politics that expresses skepticism about selling nuclear propulsion submarines to Australia, because we need them here, right? And what of course they forget, what they overlook, is that in fact the deal, it's a two-way street. Australia gets nuclear propulsion submarines, but America gets access to what was in the Second World War the biggest, most significant submarine base in the whole of the Indo-Pacific, other than Hawaii, and that was Fremantle. Cockburn Sound, just south of Fremantle, housed in the peak of the Second World War, 170 Allied submarines that were involved in interdicting shipping across the Indian Ocean throughout Southeast Asian waters. Extraordinary. That is the same piece of real estate where the nuclear propulsion submarines are supposed to be based. The other thing which, you know, I think people are saying, oh, well, you know, the AUKUS SSN's not going to work. The Americans are struggling to get enough Virginias built. Sure, they're having troubles, but I don't think they're insurmountable ones. And I think the logic for sharing their technologies with Australia is compelling for a couple of important reasons. As I say, one is the Americans get access to Cockburn Sound, to Fremantle, which, as I say, was people have forgotten this bit, but 80 years ago, that place was a hive of, you know, submarine activity that the likes of which has not been seen before or since anywhere in the world, arguably. So that's one thing. But on another point, I think, my colleague Hugh White, you know, his office, a few doors down from me, in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at ANU, we've locked horns on this a little bit in the past. But his argument that we should just get a lot of submarines, not a lot of smaller ones, it flies in the face of a couple of problems. One is that we can barely crew six at the moment, and the idea of, you know, he's proposed 40. Where are they coming from? You know, that's just there's no answer there. And of course, the other one is the one that hasn't really been focused on very much yet, Michelle, and I think is the foundational problem, and that is that China now has almost saturation, polar low Earth orbit satellite coverage of the oceans, and coupled with artificial intelligence, they are now in a position to detect the snorkel of a diesel electric submarine recharging its batteries because of the wake of the snorkel being detectable. So what we found, so Collins class submarine, it's a perfectly fine piece of kit. In fact, we've made it so good, it's best of its class in the world. It's irrelevant because you can't transit from Melbourne to Fremantle undetected. You can't stay underwater that duration. You have to snort, and in snorting, you become targetable. And if you're targetable, then you should go home. So in the absence of a mechanism to stay stealthy with a diesel electric, the only viable option is to stay underwater. And the only way to do that, well, for a big country like Australia, where to transit to any other port requires exposure, is nuclear propulsion. And that's the part of the equation most people haven't got their heads around yet. So we are keeping our coal and submarines because we don't have any other option. But the fleet, submarine rotational force west, as it's been called, is already kicking in. So people are saying, oh, well, we're not going to see these subs for 10 or 15 years. I'm thinking, look, it doesn't really matter in terms of the deterrent effect. That's already kicked in. We've already had a Virginia-class submarine stay at Fremantle, dock at Fremantle, and basically commence that pattern of behavior where nuclear propulsion submarines operate in and out of Fremantle. That's a game changer. That game has already changed. And most of the critics, most of those denouncing AUKUS, don't get that bit.
Even if AUKUS stays on track, should the Indo-Pacific be worried anyway about a possible US step back from allies here if Trump is elected? Should we be starting to prepare for that step back now?
So the great irony, of course, Michelle, is that that's half the reason why we're doing this. We want this technology. We want all this kit. We want all this manufacturing capability onshore, just in case they're not going to come if we need them. That's the harsh reality of it all. Behind all the talk of mateship and common values and interests and all that, is we are trying to hedge our bets and protect ourselves with the best kit money can buy, and that kit is overwhelmingly US sourced.
So more generally, should the Australian government be concerned about another Trump presidency, which certainly is on the cards?
Yeah, this is a good one. It's a tough one because, you know, for a middle power like Australia, we value the rules-based international order. Now, there's lots of people decrying the call of the rules-based order. To me, it's a bit like the Holy Roman Empire of old. It wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it was barely an empire. And it doesn't mean it didn't exist. And similarly with the international rules-based order, sure, there's plenty of, you know, countries that break the rules. The United States is amongst the leaders, not the only one by a long shot, but it is still nonetheless foundational to that order. We sell and we buy internationally across the seas, confident that the rules will hold, that our credit is good, that our goods will get to market safely, and that we will then in return procure something else of value to Australia. This is the international order. We forget that that order previously didn't exist, and we've taken it for granted. But since the Second World War, that order, for all its faults and all its warts and evils along the way, has stood us all in remarkably good stead, to the point where, you know, not what, 9 billion of us now are actually able to be relatively prosperous, and proportionally and numerically the number of people below the poverty line is at incredibly low compared to the past. So you can say this is terrible, that, you know, the Trump administration, you know, it will be catastrophe. I think the Trump administration, if we think about what might happen, it's useful to reflect on what they did last time, and they walked away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the free trade agreement. They criticized the Koreans. They criticized NATO. So if Trump was to go a step further on those and perhaps walk away from those relationships, that would be terrible. From a purely selfish Australian point of view, I suspect the United States, because there are enduring and continuing American interests invested in Australia, they will be fairly respectful of Australia and deferential, because they can't afford to lose us. They need us as much as we need them, I would contend. And that's partly financial. You know, we forget that the greatest foreign direct investment in Australia is America. The greatest economic partner of Australia is the United States of America. Currently trade, yes, a lot with China, a lot with others, but the net economic effect of America in the world is overwhelmingly in Australia's favour. And let's face it, let's think what's just happened with the ASEAN summit in Melbourne. All of those countries behind closed doors are secretly very eager for the United States to remain engaged. Singapore and the Philippines and Vietnam, the leaders perhaps in that space, but the others are quietly cheering them on too, just not too loudly. They don't want to annoy China.
Now, of course, the conflict in the Middle East has rather taken attention away from the war in Ukraine. What's your feeling about the continuing American and Western support for Ukraine? Do you think that it's going to dry up? And if so, what would be the implications of that for broader security in Europe?
So if you ask the Baltics, the Poles, or most of the Eastern Europeans, they're deeply nervous about this. I think we are probably going to go through a period of significant setbacks for Ukraine in the coming while. The United States, I suspect, will nonetheless come good in the coming months in terms of the deal with Ukraine. But if they do not, it will be beholden on Europe to make up the shortfall. And I think there is a recognition in large parts of Europe that the government of Vladimir Putin is one that is deeply hostile to them and to their freedoms, and would happily see them crippled, if not re-submerged into, you know, an echo of the Soviet Union. Just ask any of the leaders of the Baltics or the Eastern Europeans, Hungary excepted. Viktor Orban's the only one who stands out on that front. And even all the Scandinavians as well. The resolution was hard to imagine prior to the invasion of Ukraine, and the resolution overwhelmingly, from what I can see, remains strong. It is, of course, undermined to a certain extent by the distraction of managing domestic unrest arising from the protest movement that springs as a result of the war in Gaza. So these are interconnected to a certain extent. We know that Iran is helping the Houthis in Yemen. We know that China is supportive of Iran. We know Iran does deals and supplies weapons to Russia. So, you know, they're not completely separated. There are links. And I think most analysts and most governments of the West are recognizing that. But of course, along the way, there is a deep worry that much of the global South is being lost to the cause of the West by the evident double standards that are being maintained over Gaza versus Ukraine. And this is deeply, deeply problematic.
Just finally, John Blaxland, what's the political atmosphere like there in Washington?
So, you know, you have a sample of one here. So, you know, it's not a very scientific sample. I catch the metro to work. I live very close to the Capitol. And I, you know, on a personal level, it's, and I lived here a bit over 20 years ago. So I remember what it used to be like. And it's an unhappy place. It's a bit tense. People are worried about what the future might look like.
And what particularly are they worried about? The economics, the politics?
This is an overwhelmingly Democrat town. And, you know, President Trump's talked about draining the swamp, and that's a deeply, deeply unsettling prospect.
And more widely in the country?
Well, you know, Michelle, your guess is as good as mine. I watch as much TV as time allows, given all the other priorities in my life. I try and keep abreast of things. The United States it's a massive country. It's the size of Australia, continental US, but it's got, you know, 15 times the population. In very busy, doing their own things, focused on their own concerns, and not worried about issues abroad or further afield. But they are deeply worried about the border, it appears. They're deeply worried about abortion on both sides of the debate. They're deeply worried about the spending on foreign issues that don't seem to matter much domestically. And yet, as you know, there's been lots of reporting on this, the fact that the Biden administration seems to be doing pretty well, actually. The economy is chugging along quite nicely, but that doesn't seem to be resonating yet as much as perhaps it should.
So is this a democracy in crisis, or is that overstating the problem?
So, you know, as a historian, I look back and I think there's been so many moments of crisis that this country has faced and overcome. Of course, the Revolutionary War itself, the Civil War a century later, the Great Depression following the crash of the Wall Street in 1929 and into the 1930s. It seemed in the 1930s that the United States was going nowhere. That same sense of malaise was evident in the post-Vietnam years, or in the Vietnam years with the protest movement, in the years of leading up to the Iranian hostage rescue. You know, America is a country of, you know, extremes and superlatives, and it has an uncanny ability to bounce back. This is a particularly risky and tetchy and, dare I say, dark moment in American history, but it's been through several of them in the past, and it has the economics would suggest that the resilience and the institutional frameworks, I think, are still, they're not ones that the Americans can crow about nearly as much as they once did. There's little for them to crow about nowadays, but I think they are still necessarily robust enough to handle the prevailing winds, if you like.
John Blaxland, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your insights, and at quite a late hour too in Washington. That's all for today's Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ben Roper. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.